Hello. So my name is Peter Simons. I work with CIMA, which is the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants. And we are co-sponsors today, as we are every year for nearly 39 years now, I think, with our friendly rivals, the ICAEW. And I'm very pleased to call upon two arch rivals in Rick Payne and David Lyford-Smith. Where? Lyford-Smith. There he is, David. Oh, he's coming up later, sorry. And they're going to talk about the ABCD of new technologies and accounting. Let's see what they know.
We know a lot, Peter, we know a lot. And one of the things we know, that if you're talking about new technologies, you don't wear a tie, you don't wear a jacket, and you probably wear a T-shirt and ripped jeans. Most of our members who work in AI and technologies, it is quite amazing that they have started to dress down significantly. Anyway, funnily enough, we were talking about new technologies and finance function and accounting back in 2012 at MARG. It was my colleagues Robert Hodgkinson and Kirsten Gillen. And we themed that round a bigger picture, which was David Hockney exhibiting paintings he'd put on an iPhone or he'd drawn on an iPad. A couple of months ago, I was back at the Royal Academy and I could don my virtual reality headset, I could walk inside a Renaissance painting, and I could draw in 3D. Badly, I admit, but I could do it. And then a couple of weeks back, I was in New York at the Museum of Modern Art. And they had an exhibition, Thinking Machines, Art and Design in the Computer Age, 1959 to 1989. So think in the same way that artists have been influenced by new technologies, have influenced new technologies, have been innovative around new technologies, so can accountants. And we owe it to the profession to actually be innovative with new technologies. Our message in 2012 was you need to engage with new technologies if you're going to understand them and make use of them for the good of yourselves, for the good of companies, and for the good of society. And that message hasn't changed. What has changed is some of the technologies. And we were asked to sort of introduce what some of these technologies are actually about. Apologies to those of you who already have a very good idea about them. And what we found works really well is to talk in terms of A, B, C, D. Keep it simple. Artificial intelligence and automation, blockchain, cybersecurity, and data. Now, cybersecurity is in brackets, in the C's in brackets, because we're not going to talk about cyber, important though it is, because we haven't got time. I'm going to focus on artificial intelligence and automation and data, and my colleague David is going to brief you on blockchain. So that's the plan. I think we want to demonstrate through examples that these technologies are relevant whether you're in a big or a small company, whether you're a specialist or a generalist, whether you're a practitioner or an academic, or a mixture of all of those things. So let's start with data. Now, I could trot out some meaningless statistic about how data has grown over the last X number of years. You've probably heard it all before. And I do wonder how much of that data is actually useful, because a fair percentage of that data is about cats and pictures thereof or videos thereof. But I think some of it has proved to be useful, and we can see that in our day-to-day lives. We've engaged with businesses and accountants to try and look at how they're using data. So one of the reports we have upstairs is some work we've been doing in China, which, as Al pointed out, is one of the leading lights when it comes to using big data. We've worked with Tencent, China Mobile. And we've noticed things like them using sensors to pick up data and move from doing their costing on a monthly basis to possibly doing it on a shift basis by using sensors. But my favourite example that we picked up recently, and one of the experts we work with in AI and data, relates to a local butcher's. So the butcher's was struggling with its profitability, and our colleague Bernard Maher walked in there, they told him about this problem, he said, I might be able to help you with that. So let's get some data. So they bought a very cheap sensor that just picked up the footfall going past the shop and the number of people coming into the shop, And of course, they had the sales data to know how much they were selling. So they thought, okay, that gives us our baseline. Let's do some experiments about how we can get more people into the shop. So with their blackboard, the height of modern technology, they started writing on different ideas, discounts, recipes, specific recipes, venison stew. They found the discounts didn't really work because that was just competing with the supermarkets. But what did work was this idea of recipes that sort of suited the weather. So they now had a good way of getting more people into the shop. But they also noticed, perhaps not surprisingly, there was a big footfall on a Friday night and a Saturday night. People coming out of the pubs, hungry. So the obvious thing to do would have been to set up a burger stand, pretty standard hot dog stand, or something like that. But they thought, well, no, let's check out Google Trends. And this was quite an affluent area. And on Google Trends, it found that lots of people were searching for recipes on pulled pork and chorizo. So they set up a premium stand. And it did wonderful business, now 50% of their profits, and more people coming in to the shop. If a small business like a butcher can use data, can test experiments, and make it help a business perform, then I think as management accountants, as researchers, we've got to find ways of educating people to make the most of these new technologies. I was asked to talk about something that's causing quite a lot of confusion. It's also making great strides. Robotic process automation. There's actually one of the leading experts in robotic process automation sits in the London School of Economics, who we've worked with, Professor Leslie Wilcox. She's written a couple of books on the topic, and we have our own publications. Now, robotic process automation is not about physical robots, it's about general purpose software. It's the sort of thing that just goes into multiple systems, pulls data out, keys things in. It's like a human keying things into a system. It can sort of take a PDF, take that data, put it in your accounts payable system. It can check a form and say that data's missing, automatically send an email, get that data in, and process it. Not particularly sophisticated, rules-based and routine. If you want to, people talk about the swivel chair problem in shared services, where people go from one terminal to another terminal to key things in. Some people find that macros on steroids is a really good way of describing it. But what's really different about this technology? These sorts of things have been around. Well, the first thing is you don't have to interfere with any of the underlying technologies. Your ERP system, your Excel spreadsheets, or whatever, they can all continue potentially to run as they do. They're easy to code. Even I've managed to code a robot. And we are seeing genuine returns on investment. Not as big as the hype you may hear from the consultants of sort of hundreds of percent, but definitely tens of percent return on investment. And it's not just about cost savings. We're seeing people get greater speed, greater accuracy, getting through bottlenecks, month-end peaks, all of these things. And you don't, again, have to be a huge organisation. We reckon, on average, if you can save three people in a process, you can make the business case on cost alone. So we think this is going to have a big impact, and we'll talk later about the whole sort of jobs issue very briefly right at the end. And just to prove that anyone can do it, this is what I started to build in, something you can download for free and play with UiPath. But probably the technology that's vying in the hype cycle with blockchain, which we'll come on to in terms of peak hype, is artificial intelligence. And we're seeing examples of so-called AI washing with companies. But there's genuinely something going on. There are lots of definitions of what AI actually is. On some definitions, a thermostat is AI. Senses its environment, tries to meet a goal, and adjusts accordingly. It has a human-like quality in that lots of times it doesn't work. The number of times I've been into a room and the temperature's wrong is unbelievable. The other sort of definitions sort of hinge around something uniquely human in sort of perception, learning, rationality, and interaction. The problem with that definition is that almost once you've solved a problem, it's no longer artificial intelligence because it's no longer uniquely human. And we start to take things for granted. So when Big Blue beat Garry Kasparov, oh, big, success for artificial intelligence, and then people say, well, it's not really that impressive, is it, really? And then we get Go, the human champion of Go, being beaten, which wasn't expected to happen for at least another 10 years. And again, we start to think, well, is that really artificial intelligence? We see machine learning, just that's a term that comes up, just as a subfield, really, of AI, where most of the successes are being found. And we can talk more about that in the questions if you want. But what are the accounting-specific sort of examples of use of artificial intelligence? Well, I chatted to Steve beforehand to make sure we didn't have any overlap, and we know that Microsoft use machine learning for their forecasts to Wall Street, and I think Steve's going to talk a little bit more about that. If any of you look at AP or Bloomberg commentaries on financial results, they're now pretty much written by robots. The standard commentary is written by robots, and we know in management accounting departments and big organizations, they're writing the basic commentaries. So if you're a management accountant who writes those really poor commentaries which says, costs have gone up by 10%, isn't that wonderful or bad? You know, the robot's going to be able to do that level of commentary for you. For smaller companies, the AI will largely be seen by being built into the software. So one of the examples that's coming up at the moment is a software called Xero. It's an accounting package for small businesses in the cloud, very successful. And they have built one of the best user interfaces for an accounting system for small businesses to input their data. And when it was handed over to the accountants, they found that the accountants, the biggest sort of function they were using was find and replace. Because all the entrepreneur was doing was picking the top of the list from the drop-down menu. And everything was going to, I don't know, something beginning with A. So I thought, well, how can we solve this? So they've used pretty simple machine learning techniques. So now after you've entered 50 documents, it will suggest to you the code. And I thought, yeah, some probably hype. So I mentor an FD of a small company who uses Xero. So I said to him, I've heard about this, can you show me? He said, don't think I've seen that. Let's have a look. So he starts keying in some data, and lo and behold, it was bringing up the ledger code. It would have been invisible to him, he'd just taken it for granted, but that was basic machine learning in action. So we are, as accountants, going to see this coming through, and it is going to have increasing practical implications. But as I say, beware the hype. Announcements of AI breakthroughs come thick and fast, but they're often in the lab, or it's about to be launched, or we're doing this project, and the reality then hits. So we know of examples in the energy sector that they were going to use this wonderful avatar to deal with questions, got canned. We know of cancer, sort of big fanfare about solving cancer, way behind and over budget. We know in Australia a chatbot that was designed to deal with disability questions has been delayed. So we do have to be very careful because it is getting overhyped. And at that higher level decision making, I always come back to the paper by Hazelbeck, Merchant and Sandino, and I've spoken to Ken about this, and the actual real substance of the paper is not this part, but just the fact that they found this company that had a very simple, successful business model, that they went on to test through statistical testing, which you guys are all great at, they couldn't prove the business model. So how are we going to get artificial intelligence that's able to sort of work at that more strategic business model level? I think that's a long way off. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, they're becoming democratized. And that's largely in part due to Microsoft. So I said to Steve, I'll do the sales pitch and then you don't have to. But I've been dabbling with machine learning just to make myself more aware of how these things work. So there's Microsoft Azure Machine Learning Studio. Again, you can use it free on a non-commercial basis. And I've been able to cut and paste, drop boxes in, and build quite complex models and use, for example, an artificial neural network on forecasting data. Now, actually, artificial neural nets don't work particularly well for time series at the moment. It's not really enough data. But just the fact that we're going to be able to do this, almost whatever our skill level, is really fascinating to me. Chatbots with Microsoft Q&A Maker, even easier. A 12-year-old, I reckon, or younger, could build a chatbot using Q&A Maker, which perhaps have a record for who's the youngest chatbot builder in Q&A Maker. It was so easy as to be scary. Now, it's not a sophisticated chatbot. I think Steve's going to show more an example of a more sophisticated one. But if you think we've had a wild west of spreadsheets and all the fun and games that that's potentially created, think what we might get as these technologies are democratized, for good and for bad. We're not going to touch on ethics unless you bring it up in the questions. It's a massive issue, ethics, and we've done a lot of thinking on it, but we're stuck for time. I'm now going to hand over to David, I'm fractionally over time, who we've tried to give as much time as possible to talk about blockchain, because blockchain's a relatively difficult concept to grasp unless you've spent some time on it. I've learned all I know about blockchain from David, so I think you'll really find out a lot, David.
Well, thanks very much, Rick. I almost forgot that I had a bit coming up. I was so engrossed in viewing your energy and your excitement about those two topics. I'm going to try and match that with a little bit of a talk about blockchain and what it's all about. If you've been by our stand upstairs already, you might recognise this image. It's actually on the cover of our blockchain report, and you might think, oh, well, that's kind of cute. It's some blocks, and they're kind of laid out in a chain. That's neat. But actually, what I'm going to try and talk to you about over next 15 minutes or so is a little bit about what blockchain is all about and why actually this image is a little bit more deep in its meaning and its relation to blockchain than you might first think. I am an accountant. I come at these things from an accounting perspective, so I'm going to try and give what I think is my beliefs about blockchain and what we've interpreted it as in our work at ICAW, and talk to it how I think about it. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the tech, but as little as I can get away with, really, because it's not really that relevant. First of all, what really is blockchain in a nutshell? As an accountant, I think of it as universal entry bookkeeping. Blockchain is a system that allows you to spread and share information between lots of different parties, whether they be within the same organization or different organizations, but keep getting that same information to everyone and getting everyone to agree on it. In the way that, as if you had a magic book where you could write a debit transaction and the same information appears in everyone else's book. And you might think, oh, well, we already have the internet. We have ways of sharing information with lots of other people already. But there's a lot more going on with blockchain that means it's attracting a lot of interest. I'm going to talk a little bit about blockchain's features, but to talk about why, well, what is blockchain, first of all, as a technology? Is it a device, or is it a process or a system? It's a process. It's a business process that lets you spread information to lots of different people in a way that's totally secure, in a way that everybody knows what is what, that everybody agrees on what's what. There's no need for reconciliation. Everyone has the same records, and you can do that without needing one person in the middle to trust. If I want to pay somebody in real life, and the simplest way to do that is with physical cash. I can just hand it over to them, only the two of us are involved, and then that person is £5 richer and I'm £5 poorer, and that's all that needs to be done. If I want to pay somebody on the internet, however, I cannot sadly send them a photograph of my £5 notes. It doesn't work, because on the internet, if you send something to someone, you've still got it. You've still got your email, you've still got the data, I've still got my £5 note. That ability to move something from one place to another, we don't have just between the two of us on the internet. If I want to send someone money on the internet, I have to go to my bank or to PayPal. I have to talk to them and get them to update their records. And so blockchain is an attempt to solve, create a kind of an alternative solution where we have that useful ability to transact peer-to-peer in technology terms, but person-to-person, with trust, with certainty, we know what's going on, we have correct records, but we don't have to pay a central person to do that. It has three key qualities, which we describe using these three P's. First one is propagation, and that's this concept I've been talking about, spreading out. We have lots of identical records and no one master copy. Blockchain is a process that basically helps everybody converge on one version of the truth. It's something that pushes everybody in the direction of having a single ledger, a single copy of how the world works, and a single view of how that history of the transactions has been put together. So we've all got our own copies, and they're all kept up to date, but we don't have to do reconciliations, we don't have to worry about disagreeing with each other's records and everyone having different information, because the the process of making blockchain transactions is done in a way that keeps everybody's records the same. So we all have the master copy, or none of us do, depending on how you want to think of that philosophically. So propagation, the spreading out of new information so that everybody ends up with an identical record. A consequence of that is the second feature, which is permanence. Because there's no master copy, we don't have to worry about whoever has the master copy changing it. The bank, if they wanted to, can change their records to reflect a new reality, and I can't do anything really to stop them. But in a blockchain world, there is no central party with control. And this actually ties into the structure of blockchain. The structure of blockchain is a chain made out of blocks. Unsurprising, I think. What does that actually mean, though? It means that new transactions, we don't post them immediately. We gather them together into blocks. We make sure that all the transactions in that block look good, and then a new block is added to a chain of all of the previous transactions. And so each set of transactions comes with some backwards links that identify what came before. And that chain structure means that actually changes and alterations become impossible. We all have the same record. We all have the same information from the propagation of that. So if I suddenly decide to try and fiddle my copy of the records to show that I've got more money than I should, or that I've sent a shipment that I haven't, everyone else can immediately repudiate that because they have their own records that say differently. And they can confirm that their records are all the same, and it's just me who's trying to be different, like that one red balloon stand out like a sore thumb. And the third feature isn't universal. Not every blockchain has it, but it is very common and very popular, and it's one of the areas that it brings a lot of excitement about blockchain, and that's programmability, and that's what's often called a smart contract, which is a fancy term, really, for a bit of automatic transaction making, familiar, of course, from vending machines. A vending machine is a mechanical smart contract. It is a piece of mechanical engineering and electronic engineering that lets you purchase crisps and chocolate from a company that isn't present, hasn't got an agent where you are, for cash or card these days. Doesn't always work because it's mechanical, and sometimes mechanical parts fail, and sometimes chocolate bars lean against the inside of the glass and don't fall out properly. But software doesn't have those problems. And with software, you can create a contract or an arrangement that's built completely out of software. Because it's software, you can read it ahead of time, maybe run it on a test environment ahead of time to see what it does and see how it works. And then you know that when a certain thing comes up, that that's what's going to happen. So blockchain can contain not just past transactions, but instructions for future ones. As I said, not every blockchain solution out there offers this, but it is very common. And this could be something like setting up a software escrow account. So I could create something where it has an automatic trigger condition. When this trigger condition happens, this payment is made to this party. Or something really complicated, like what's described here as a digital autonomous organization, or DAO. That's a kind of an investment vehicle, or a company that lives completely on the network, is completely built out of bits of software interacting with one another. And that brings me back to the cover image. So this is to do not only with dominoes and blocks, but actually to do with the structure of the game of dominoes. And if you don't know, that means that if I'm a person playing dominoes, I have to place a tile that matches the previous tile. So as this game is continuing, you can see with the pincers down here, we're placing this 2-5 tile. And that first part of my new tile isn't a surprise. It has to be a 2. That's a validation piece. And that is just something that confirms the data in the previous block. And the 5, that's the new information, that's the new transactions, that's the new game state that I'm adding on the end. So I know that the next block that's added has to start with a 5. I don't yet know what it's going to continue with. And blockchain uses exactly this structure. And the nice thing about this structure is that if we're playing dominoes by post, and we're sending each other photos of the board as we make our moves, I can't change, let's say, that 1-6 kind of in the middle there to anything else. Now that we've gone past that point, only 1-6 fits in that place. Nothing else could possibly be there. If I wanted to try and change that, I would have to change the next block. And if I change the next block, well, then the one after that doesn't fit, and I'd have to change that one as well. And blockchain is designed so that that's impossible. I'm never going to be able to catch up to the current transactions by going back and trying to re-engineer history, I'll never be able to catch up. I will never be able to change anything. So it's actually very similar. Of course, Domino's only has 6 different possible transactions, and the real world has slightly more than that. So it's a little bit more complicated, but really that is the general structure that it uses. Want to talk about a few use cases. I managed to go a little bit over 10 minutes without saying the other B word, but Bitcoin is one of them. Bitcoin and blockchain come from the same place. They come from a white paper in 2008 written by somebody who used the name Satoshi Nakamoto. Their actual identity is unknown. They had this idea of an online currency that's been, actually the idea of an online currency has been around for ages, but they decided they had a particular go at doing it. The major difference with them is that they said, okay, well, we need a system that will let us track this and so that it's as easy to use as cash, so that it has that flexibility that cash has, that there's no cost, there's no intermediate party, there's no trust issues, I can just hand it to whomever I want. And the system that they came up with came to be called blockchain. They started running an experimental blockchain with a few other people from their cryptography forum in 2009, in January, started trading some Bitcoin between each other just to check that everything works, and those transactions are still in the record of the same blockchain that is running right now, the Bitcoin network with billions of dollars of Bitcoin. It's exactly the same one, it's just been running since. In about 2010, 11, I can't remember exactly when, the experiment had started to get a little bit more solidified. Somebody decided to try and actually do a real, genuine financial transaction with it. So they paid their friend for 2 Domino's pizzas. They paid 10,000 Bitcoin for those 2 pizzas, which was about the price of 2 Domino's pizzas at the time, and is a few million dollars now. So that's the background of Bitcoin. The only thing I really want to say about Bitcoin is that Bitcoin is not blockchain, and blockchain is not Bitcoin. This is where the technology comes from, but a lot of the features of how Bitcoin works are intentional design choices for how they want Bitcoin to work. Not every blockchain has to use the structure that Bitcoin uses. So Bitcoin, for example, is super open. Anyone with an internet connection can go and view the entire Bitcoin blockchain. Every transaction, every history, how much money is in every Bitcoin wallet. That's an intentional design decision, and it would not have to be the same for every possible solution. Second one I want to talk about is supply chain integration. A little bit of different examples. There are lots of different projects out there looking to try to help with these cases where you've got lots and lots of different companies involved in supply chains or in trading commerce in particular markets, all of whom have different information and need to know different things. And again, the struggle is trying to keep everyone together. And so the intention here is to use blockchains to solve those problems. Less open than Bitcoin, only visible to the people who are players in that network, but still a consortium, still a situation where lots of people need to get to one version of the truth. I've got one example here about shipping, but actually there's 2 or 3 different shipping-related projects of relevance, because this is an excellent example of something where a shipping container in transit might go between 30 different parties and 100 different transactions, even if it goes very swimmingly. And actually, an awful lot of that process is paper-based. Even now, it revolves at least partially around taking paper documents to a port authority to have them physically stamped. And there's a huge amount of difference and difficulty in getting people to agree. So the idea is, if you can get a blockchain standard that everybody agrees on, and that's a pretty big if, you can use a blockchain to solve that. Last example, then, land registry. Land registry is one of those things that we get generally run by governments because nobody else wants to do it, but it's something that is economically useful to have clarity over who owns all the different pieces of land in a particular area or particular country. It's quite expensive and slow, and in a lot of parts of the world you have to really worry about corruption. You have to worry about, will the civil servant get paid off by somebody to make an alteration to steal my land on paper for out from under me? And blockchain offers a possible improvement there. Current blockchains are reasonably clunky. They're quite slow and expensive to operate compared to things like Visa. So they're not really ready to take over payments architecture, but they are much better in things like than the existing solutions we have in things like cross-border payments, settlement of capital markets, and things like land registry. And of course, we have the advantage that they are unrepudiatable, they are unchangeable, nobody has the authority or ability, nobody can technically change those histories and say, actually, all those oil fields that Shell are using, I own those now, they have to pay me rent instead of whoever had it last week. So those are a few different examples of where blockchain is out there. I just want to go mention again the report. We've got a couple of copies left on the stands upstairs by where the coffee will be later. But actually, for all four of the ABCD topics, we have short form URLs on our website as well. They're all very easy. So it's all icaew.com/ and then /AI for AI, /blockchain for blockchain, /cyber for cyber, and /big data for data. And we have hub sites with all of the kind of thought leadership papers and information about those things that we do in each of those. So that's my little bit about blockchain. I think Rick's going to come up and just kind of sum up everything before we head into the questions. So here you are.
Thank you, David. Yeah, so I just wanted to say a little bit around, well, what's the ultimate impact of all of this? And clearly there's a big worry about job losses. The answer is we don't know. There was a survey or some research done by Pew Research, and they asked experts, and 48% of experts think there will be more job losses than there will be job creation, and 52% of experts think there will be more jobs created than are lost. The reality is I think there will be a lot of disruption. We're talking to firms. I run a robotics process automation working group, and we're seeing that the numbers of people employed, particularly in shared service centres, is coming down as a result of robotics. And that's just a simple piece of architecture. We think the solution, if you like, for all of us to maintain our relevance is to engage with these new technologies. As I've said, you can go out and try these things now relatively easily. I am concerned for anyone who's burying their heads in the sand saying it's not going to impact me. It already is. And I do have some concerns around the academic community, because whenever I talk to data science research centres or big data research centres, I sort of ask them, so what are the accountants doing? How are they working with you? How are the management accountants involved in your research centre? And they go, they're not. Now, I think that's quite disturbing, because the skills that management accounting researchers have could contribute a lot to what's going on. So hopefully, and I know the LSE is a bit of an exception, I know that Al and Michael have done a lot of work around management accounting in new technology environments, but I think we need to follow their lead. So the main message, I think, is engage with these new technologies in whatever way feels good for you in order to maintain relevance. So we'll take a few questions, I think.
We have roving mics. There's somebody ready to ask a question already. Simon Preece.
Good afternoon, David. My question is, can you please explain what is meant by data mining? That's my first question. My second question, in terms of Bitcoin, how much is the Bitcoin worth? If you buy, for example, a car, say a Ford Transit, we know that it has a set amount of value in terms of how many pounds sterling it would cost, or how much US dollars it would cost, or how many yen it would cost. How much is the Bitcoin worth in that sense, and what is meant by data mining, please? Thank you.
Well, I'll take the Bitcoin example. So Bitcoin is in a strain, and indeed all of the 2,000 or so different cryptocurrencies that exist right now are all in this odd place in their development where their intention is to be a currency, to be cash on like internet cash, but the reality at the minute is that they aren't quite there. So while you will see that transactions will happen and people pay for services with Bitcoin and Zcash and Litecoin and et cetera, at the moment very few people price in those currencies because they're not stable enough to be a good point of reference. So, you know, a web developer will say, I take Bitcoin, but they will still say this many US dollars at market rate. And actually the companies that we see that do accept Bitcoin, and there are a few of them out there, many of them don't hold on to it. Again, they convert and then sell off their Bitcoin when they get it. So at the moment it works a bit more like a commodity really than anything. And in accounting terms and financial reporting terms and tax terms, that's kind of where it's settled down. The head of the IRS was asked about it at some point, and he said he wouldn't recommend that anybody pay for their lunch using Bitcoin because you wouldn't want to create a chargeable event when you're trying to just pay for a sub. So you know, that's the kind of gap at the moment. Mining in a Bitcoin, was it mining in a Bitcoin context? Because nobody owns and runs Bitcoin, they need, but it does take work to do the computation of checking the transactions are okay and making sure that everything fits together. The way that Bitcoin pays for the people, so that people want to help run it, is by rewarding the people who do the work with new Bitcoin. So there, that's basically in much the same way that we, you know, pay people that work at the Royal Mint with money. They just don't get to just take some off the production line at the end of the day, though. We use other systems, but for Bitcoin, that's exactly how it works. If you help Bitcoin run by doing the legwork of connecting those blocks to the chain, then you are rewarded in new Bitcoin. At the moment, 12.5 Bitcoin if you manage to figure out a block, which is $80,000, $90,000, and that happens every 10 minutes. Somebody somewhere in the world manages to do that. In terms of what it actually is on a fundamental level, sadly, is trial and error work. It's just churning a handle to try and find a special number that will allow the block to properly connect to the previous one. So Bitcoin is currently wasting a lot of energy doing that, but the reason why that has to happen is because in Bitcoin you don't know who anyone on the network is, you can't trust anyone, so you have to have a lot of security. A private business blockchain where you're only dealing with people who you have some knowledge of could use a much lower level of security and be much simpler to run and much cheaper as well.
And if you were going to, if you were sitting in Zimbabwe and you were going to play a car in dollars, you wouldn't know from one day to the next how much it was going to cost you.
No.
Similar in Bitcoin.
Very good. Other question there, please.
Paolo, how are you?
Paolo.
I knew we were going to get a question from Paolo.
Yeah, I'm curious. I start from saying that I agree with both of you in a sense that the, you know, we need to engage and this is a revolution, but I'm not sure about what the differences will be, exactly like all of us. I mean, you mentioned the three P's, David, and, you know, if I go back to Palermo, I can still read the ledgers of the kingdom of Frederick II in the ledgers, which are still there. I wonder whether blockchain will assure that in the next 50 years, because I cannot read my own undergraduate thesis. It's no longer, I mean, the file cannot be opened anymore. But also, in terms of institutions, you know, the institutions that manage blockchains may disappear because they will be very volatile. So these idea of persistence is a relatively easy idea of persistence. You know, for all the three P's, in a sense, I could make similar arguments. So I wonder how much of that is really a bit of a hype. And can you give me one example of something that we cannot do without blockchain?
I can certainly try. First of all, I completely agree that a lot of what's going on with blockchain straight up is hype. The infamous example is the Long Island iced tea company, who make powders and things for sort of reconstituted sodas, company in the US. They changed their name to the Long Island Blockchain Company, and their valuation quintupled. I don't think that they incidentally didn't actually have a blockchain project. They literally just changed their name. So that's a good sign that perhaps there is some hype going on. In fact, there's a lot of it. Where blockchain is really, really useful is in these situations where you have a large network of people who need one version of reality to work from and to have that certainty. I think that of the three examples I gave there, the one I have the most confidence in is the land registry one, because that's the one which is already currently is owned by one party who doesn't, one person, which is a government in whatever country, that doesn't particularly want to be running it, and it can be made to work, made legal, and done in a better way. Blockchain really isn't probably going to have that many totally new things. I think it's about, it's a business process. It's a better way of doing some things. Some people think it's the way of doing everything, and that's definitely not true. But it's a new solution for helping people collaborate and have the same information, have that certainty to act and increase that kind of certainty and liquidity and kind of improve from there. You're definitely right that, you know, of the whatever thousands cryptocurrencies and startups that claim to be using blockchain, most of them will not work much the same as most of any new technologies, companies won't work.
I think there's an element of, it's not just each technology taken in isolation, it's when you're starting to bring all these technologies together that potentially the impact is much bigger.
So
each one, yeah.
I think it's also about, for many of these technologies, the impact on most people will be that they are invisible. Any of us who search for things on Google or YouTube or what have you right now, our search results are much, much better than they would be. The recommended videos on YouTube and search results on Google are much better than they used to be because of invisible machine learning behind the back around that's doing that. I suspect for a lot of blockchain it will be similar in that it will be something that's kind of put in place in a lot of large systems that increases the efficiency and security of systems, but to an end user is not really visibly different to whatever was happening before, in the same way that people don't particularly care about how TCP/IP works. They just know that their email works, and that when they send an email that someone gets it, and that the background system that makes that work is very clever, but nobody really, you know, most people, it isn't relevant to them.
Any further questions? Well, I have one.
one each.
David, most of this blockchain stuff is at proof of concept stage or projects, as you say.
Yeah.
And you know, it works for Bitcoin.
Mm.
How long do you think before these concepts will become reality?
So there are a few real life business as usual examples, but you're right that it's very much a small few. The vast majority of things are in development. Like I said, like the white paper is almost 10 years old now. It was October 2008 that this was officially put out. So it's actually been going longer than many people think. I think the real question has got to be trying to sort of... First of all, there are some security and speed issues that need to get resolved. It needs to get faster and cheaper and more efficient. It needs to be upscaled as well. Once those are solved, then I think what will happen is that the unviable models will start to shake out, and the cryptocurrencies that are just building on hype will start to go away, and it will start to become more clear. I would think that we'll probably see it being a quite common thing in 5 years, and I would be surprised if it's not common in the places where it's best suited, as I say, none of us could be totally certain about where those are a little bit later than that. If you want to, just to close, a very good example of a current company that uses it is Everledger. And they're a company that tracks mostly diamonds, but actually they're now going into other, you know, fine art and other, and wines and other high value assets. And what
Italian
they
wine Paolo, that's
yeah, that sort of things. And they are using blockchain to track provenance and ownership of those assets, particularly for diamonds, because there are 60 odd different physical and chemical measures you can make, so you can very definitely identify a diamond that way. And then they've created basically a blockchain version of the diamond, and you can see who owns it, where does it comes from, all the transactions. And that's a company that's just getting on with doing blockchain stuff now.
Very good. And I can tell you from SEMA's syllabus research that major regulators, East and West, envisage a situation where they'd be able to rely on ledgers maintained on blockchain to assess your tax returns.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of frightening.
Yeah.
So who does the auditing then? Now, so these amazing technologies, and it was great to have this session after lunch, it's so exciting, right? But these amazing technologies, they're really going to challenge current business models. What would the accountant end up doing? I mean, if I take your advice and engage with this technology, am I going to be devoured?
I think you're at more risk of being devoured if you don't engage with them. I suspect is a much bigger risk. I think one of the areas that we've been talking to people about is that the accountants and the management accountants being able to deal with the business models, as you say, and one in particular is agile development processes, which doesn't really suit traditional budgeting approaches. I was talking to a gentleman from Norway about beyond budgeting, which has some links to, I think, working with agile. So I think there's two parts. One is the management accountants being able to deal with the new business models, and Michael's written, and Al have written on this, accounting in digital environments needs to change. And then it's using them as tools. I think there's a big risk about hollowing out of the profession. So we often talk about how do people develop their sort of underlying nose for a problem and those skills that you get by doing transactional stuff. If that no longer exists, how do you develop the relevant skills? You know, I've worked for KPMG. We didn't do any incomplete records, so I was given a shoebox as a case study to build a set of accounts out of receipts and bank statements, just because we never did any clients like that. Are we going to have to create those simulations, I suppose, to train people in the basics so that they can then go on to higher level roles? We were talking to companies where they're bringing in apprentices just to get some career development people in, but then all the next jobs are senior, so there's nothing in between for these people to actually
the hollowing out of work.
Yeah. If the career ladder starts on like the third floor, how do you...
Right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I can assure you, no jackets, no ties, but real accountants all the same. And, thank you very much to my friends David and Rick from the ICAEW.